Chapter 14, The Three Messages. Verses 1 to 5. And I looked, and lo, a lamb stood on the Mount Zion, and with him 144,000, having his Father's name written in their foreheads. And I heard a voice from heaven, as the voice of many waters, and as the voice of a great thunder. And I heard the voice of harpers harping with their harps. And they sung as it were a new song before the throne, and before the four beasts and the elders. And no man could learn that song, but the 144,000, which were redeemed from the earth. These are they which are not defiled with women, for they are virgins. These are they which follow the Lamb whithersoever he goeth. These were redeemed from among men, being the firstfruits unto God and to the Lamb. And in their mouth was found no guile, for they are without fault before the throne of God. It is a pleasing feature of the prophetic word that the people of God are never brought into positions of trial and difficulty, and they are abandoned. Taking them down into scenes of danger, the voice of prophecy does not there cease, leaving them to guess their fate. In doubt, perhaps despair as to the final result, but it takes them through to the end, and shows the issue in every conflict. The first five verses of Revelation chapter 14 are an instance of this. The 13th chapter closed with the people of God, a small and apparently weak and defenseless company, in deadly conflict with the mightiest powers of earth, which the dragon is able to muster to his service. A decree is passed, backed up by the supreme power of the land, that they shall worship the image and receive the mark under pain of death if they refuse to comply. What can the people of God do in such a conflict and in such an extremity? What will become of them? Glance forward with the apostle to the very next scene in the program, and what do we behold? The very same company standing on Mount Zion with the Lamb, a victorious company, harping on harps, their triumph in the court of heaven. Thus are we assured that when the time of our conflict with the powers of darkness comes, deliverance is not only certain, but will immediately be given. That the 144,000 here seen on Mount Zion are the saints who were just before brought to view as objects of the wrath of the beast and his image, there are the very best of reasons for believing. Number one, they are identical with those sealed in Revelation chapter 7, who have already been shown to be the righteous who are alive at the second coming of Christ. Number two, they are the overcomers in the sixth, or Philadelphian, state of the church. Number three, they are redeemed from among men. Verse 4, an expression which can be applicable only to those who are translated from among the living. Paul labored if by any means he might attain to a resurrection out from among the dead. Philippians chapter 3, verse 11. This is the hope of those who sleep in Jesus, a resurrection from the dead. A redemption from among men, from among the living, must mean a different thing, and can mean only one thing, and that is translation. Hence, the 144,000 are the living saints who will be translated at the second coming of Christ. See on verse 13 note. On what Mount Zion does John see this company standing? The Mount Zion above. For the voice of harpers, which no doubt is uttered by these very ones, is heard from heaven. The same Zion from which the Lord utters his voice when he speaks to his people, in close connection with the coming of the Son of Man. Joel chapter 3, verse 16. Hebrews chapter 12, verses 26 to 28. And Revelation chapter 16, verse 17. A just consideration of the fact that there is a Mount Zion in heaven and a Jerusalem above would be a powerful antidote for the hallucination of the doctrine known as the age to come. A few more particulars only respecting the 144,000, in addition to those given in chapter 7, will claim notice in these brief remarks. Number 1. They have the name of the Lamb's Father in their foreheads. In chapter 7, they are said to have the seal of God in their foreheads. An important key to an understanding of the seal of God is thus furnished for us. For we at once perceive that the Father regards His name as His seal. That commandment of the law which contains God's name is therefore the seal of the law. The Sabbath commandment is the only one which has this. That is, that contains the descriptive title which distinguishes the true God from all false gods. Wherever this was placed, there the Father's name was said to be. Deuteronomy chapter 12, verses 5, 14, 18, and 21, chapter 14, verse 23, chapter 16, verses 2 and 6, etc. And whoever keeps this commandment has consequently the seal of the living God. Number 2. They sing a new song, which no other company is able to learn. In chapter 15, verse 3, it is called the Song of Moses and the Song of the Lamb. The Song of Moses, as may be seen by reference to Exodus chapter 15, was the song of his experience and deliverance. Therefore, the song of the 144,000 is the song of their deliverance. No others can join in it, for no other company will have had an experience like theirs. Number 3. They were not defiled with women. A woman is in Scripture the symbol of a church. A virtuous woman represents a pure church, a corrupt woman an apostate church. It is then a characteristic of this company that at the time of their deliverance, they are not defiled with or have no connection with the fallen churches of the land. Yet we are not to understand that they never had any connection with these churches, for it is only at a certain time that people become defiled by them. In chapter 18, verse 4, we find a call issued to the people of God while they are in Babylon to come out, lest they become partakers of her sins. Heeding that call and leaving her connection, they escape the defilement of her sins. So of the 144,000, though some of them may have once had a connection with corrupt churches, they sever that connection when it would become sin to retain it longer. Number 4. They follow the Lamb whithersoever He goeth. We understand that this is spoken of them in their redeemed state. They are the special companions of their glorified Lord in the kingdom. Chapter 7, verse 17, speaking of the same company, and at the same time says, "For the Lamb which is in the midst of the throne shall feed them, and shall lead them unto living fountains of waters." Number 5. They are first fruits unto God and the Lamb. This term appears to be applied to different ones to denote a special conditions. Christ is the first fruits, as the antitype of the wave sheaf. The first receivers of the gospel are called by James, chapter 1, verse 18, a kind of first fruits. So the 144,000, ripening up for the heavenly garner here on earth during the troublous scenes of the last days, being translated to heaven without seeing death, and occupying a preeminent position, are in this sense, as would seem very consistent, called firstfruits unto God and the Lamb. With this description of the 144,000 triumphant, the line of prophecy commencing with chapter 12 comes to a close. Verses 6-12. And I saw another angel fly in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel to preach unto them that dwell on the earth, and to every nation, and kindred, and tongue, and people, saying with a loud voice, "Fear God, and give glory to Him, for the hour of His judgment is come, and worship Him that made heaven, and earth, and the sea, and the fountains of waters." And there followed another angel, saying, "Babylon is fallen, that great city, because she made all nations drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication." And the third angel followed them, saying with a loud voice, "If any man worship the beast and his image, and receive his mark in his forehead or in his hand, the same shall drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out without mixture into the cup of his indignation, and he shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment ascendeth up for ever and ever, and they have no rest day nor night, who worship the beast and his image, and whosoever receiveth the mark of his name. Here is the patience of the saints. Here are they that keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus. The first message. Another scene and another chain of prophetic events is introduced in these verses. We know that this is so because the preceding verses of this chapter describe a company of the redeemed in the immortal state, a scene which constitutes a part of the prophetic chain, commencing with the first verse of chapter 12, and with which that chain of events closes. For no prophecy goes beyond the immortal state. And whenever we are brought in a line of prophecy to the end of the world, we know that the line there ends, and that what is introduced subsequently belongs to a new series of events. The Revelation in particular is composed of these independent prophetic chains, as has already been set forth, of which fact, previous to this instance, we have had a number of examples. The messages described in these verses are known as the three angels' messages of Revelation chapter 14. We are justified in applying to them the ordinals, first, second, and third, by the prophecy itself, for the last one is distinctly called the third angel, from which it follows that the one preceding was the second angel, and the one before that the first angel. These angels are evidently symbolic, for the work assigned them is that of preaching the everlasting gospel to the people. But the preaching of the gospel has not been entrusted to literal angels. It has been committed unto men, who are responsible for this sacred trust placed in their hands. Each of these three angels, therefore, symbolizes a body of religious teachers who are commissioned to make known to their fellow men the special truths which constitute the burden of these messages respectively. But we are to consider further that angels literally are intensely interested in the work of grace among men, being sent forth to minister to those who shall be heirs of salvation. And as there is order in all the movements and appointments of the heavenly world, it may not be fanciful to suppose that a literal angel has charge and oversight of the work of each message. Hebrews chapter 1, verse 14, Revelation chapter 1, verse 1, and chapter 22, verse 16. In these symbols, we see the sharp contrast the Bible draws between earthly and heavenly things. Wherever earthly governments are to be represented, even the best of them, the most appropriate symbol that can be found is a cruel and ravenous wild beast. But when the work of God is to be set forth, an angel, clad in beauty and girt with power, is taken to symbolize it. The importance of the work set forth in the verses last quoted will be apparent to anyone who will attentively study them. Whenever these messages are due and are proclaimed, they must, from the very nature of the case, constitute the great theme of interest for that generation. We do not mean that the great mass of mankind then living will give them attention, for in every age of the world the present truth for that time has been generally overlooked. But they will constitute the theme to which the people would pay most earnest regard if they were awake to that which concerns their highest interests. When God commissions his ministers to announce to the world that the hour of his judgment is come, that Babylon has fallen, and that whoever worships the beast and his image must drink of his wrath poured out unmingled into the cup of his indignation, a threatening more terrible than any other which can be found in the scriptures of truth, no man except at the peril of his soul can treat these warnings as non-essential, passing them by with neglect and disregard. Hence the necessity for the most earnest endeavor in every age, and especially in the present age, when so many evidences betoken the soon coming of earth's final crisis, to understand the work of the Lord, lest we lose the benefit of the present truth. This angel of Revelation chapter 14, verse 6 is called another angel, from the fact that John had previously seen an angel flying through heaven in a similar manner, as described in chapter 8, verse 13, proclaiming that the last three of the series of seven trumpets were woe trumpets. This was near the close of the 6th century. See under chapter 8, verse 12. The first point to be determined is the chronology of this message. When may the proclamation, "The hour of his judgment is come," be consistently expected? The bare possibility that it may be in our day renders it very becoming us to examine this question with serious attention. But the great probability, nay more, the positive proof that this is so, which will appear in the development of this argument, should set every pulse pounding and every heart beating high with a sense of the thrilling importance of this hour. Three positions only are possible on this question of the chronology of this prophecy, and as might be expected, all of them are taken by different expositors. These positions are, number one, that this message has been given in the past, as first in the days of the apostles, or secondly in the days of the reformers. Number two, that it is given in a future age, or number three, that it belongs to the present generation. We inquire first respecting the past. The very nature of the message forbids the idea that it could have been given in the apostles' days. They did not proclaim that the hour of God's judgment had come. If they had, it would not have been true, and their message would have been stamped with the infamy of falsehood. They did have something to say, however, respecting the judgment, but they pointed to an indefinite future for its accomplishment. In Matthew chapter 10, verse 15, and chapter 11, verses 21 to 24, a quotation from Christ's own words, "The judgment of Sodom and Gomorrah, Tyre, Sidon, Chorazin, and Capernaum was located indefinitely in the future from that day." Paul declared to the superstitious Athenians that God had appointed a day in which he would judge the world. Acts chapter 17, verse 31. He reasoned before Felix of righteousness, temperance, and judgment to come. Acts chapter 24, verse 25. To the Romans he wrote, directing their minds forward to a day when God should judge the secrets of men by Jesus Christ. Romans chapter 2, verse 16. He pointed the Corinthians forward to a time when we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ. 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 10. James wrote to the brethren scattered abroad that they were at some time in the future to be judged by the law of liberty. James chapter 2, verse 12. And both Peter and Jude speak of the first rebel angels as reserved unto the judgment of the great day, still in the future at that time. 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 4, and Jude chapter 6, to which the ungodly in this world are also reserved. 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 9. How different is all this from ringing out upon the world the startling declaration that the hour of his judgment is come, a sound which must be heard whenever the solemn message before us is fulfilled. From the days of the apostles, nothing has taken place which anyone, so far as we are aware, could construe into a suggestion of the fulfillment of the message, till we come to the Reformation of the 16th century. Here, some seem disposed to make quite a determined stand, claiming that Luther and his co-laborers gave the first message, and that the two following messages have been given since his day. This is a question to be decided by historical fact rather than by argument, and hence we inquire for the evidence that the Reformers made any such proclamation. Their teaching has been very fully recorded and their writings preserved. When and where did they arouse the world with the proclamation that the hour of God's judgment had come? We find no record that such was the burden of their preaching at all. On the contrary, it is recorded of Luther that he placed the judgment some 300 years in the future from his day. Such records ought to be decisive so far as the Reformers are concerned. The foregoing considerations, being sufficient to forbid utterly the application of the message to the past, we now turn to that view which locates it in a future age. By future age is meant a period subsequent to the Second Advent, and the reason urged for locating the message in that age is the fact that John saw the angel flying through heaven immediately after having seen the Lamb stand on Mount Zion with the 144,000, which is a future event. If the book of Revelation were one consecutive prophecy, there would be force in this reasoning. But as it consists of a series of independent lines of prophecy, and as it has already been shown that one such chain ends with verse 5 of this chapter, and a new one begins with verse 6, the foregoing view cannot be urged. To show that the message cannot have its fulfillment in a future age, it will be sufficient to remark. Number 1. The Apostolic Commission extended only to the harvest, which is the end of the world. If therefore this angel with the everlasting gospel comes after that event, he preaches another gospel and subjects himself to the anathema of Paul in Galatians chapter 1, verse 8. Number 2. The second message cannot, of course, be given before the first, but the second message announces the fall of Babylon, and a voice is heard from heaven after that, saying, "Come out of her, my people." How absurd to locate this after the second advent of Christ, seeing that all God's people, both living and dead, are at that time caught up to meet the Lord in the air, to be thenceforth forever with Him. They cannot be called out of Babylon after this. Christ does not take them to Babylon, but to the Father's house, where there are many mansions. John chapter 14, verses 2 and 3. Number 3. A glance at the third angel's message, which must be fulfilled in a future age if the first one is, will still further show the absurdity of this view. This message warns against the worship of the beast, which refers beyond question to the papal beast. But the papal beast is destroyed and given to the burning flame when Christ comes. Daniel chapter 7, verse 11, and 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 8. He goes into the lake of fire at that time to disturb the saints of the Most High no more. Revelation chapter 19, verse 20. Why will people involve themselves in the absurdity of locating a message against the worship of the beast at a time when the beast has ceased to exist and his worship is impossible? In verse 13 of Revelation chapter 14, a blessing is pronounced upon the dead which die in the Lord from henceforth, that is, from the time the third message begins to be given. This is a complete demonstration of the fact that the message must be given prior to the first resurrection. For after that event, all who have a part therein, and this includes all both living and dead who are not assigned to the second death, become as the angels of God and can die no more. We therefore dismiss this view concerning the future age as unscriptural, absurd, and impossible. We are now prepared to examine the third view, that the message belongs to the present generation. The argument on the two preceding points has done much to establish the present proposition. For if the message has not been given in the past, and cannot be given in the future after Christ comes, where else can we locate it but in the present generation, if we are in the last days as we suppose? Indeed, the very nature of the message itself confines it to the last generation of men. It proclaims the hour of God's judgment come. But the judgment pertains to the closing up of the work of salvation for the world, and the proclamation announcing its approach can therefore be made only as we come near the end. It is further shown that the message belongs to the present time, when it is proved that this angel is identical with the angel of Revelation chapter 10, who utters his message in this generation, that the first angel of Revelation chapter 14 and the angel of Revelation 10 are identical, see argument on the latter chapter. But the strongest and most conclusive evidence that the message belongs to the present time will consist in finding some movement in this generation through which its fulfillment has been or is going forward. On this point, we refer to a movement of which it would now be hard to find anyone who is wholly ignorant. It is the great Advent movement of the last century. As early as 1831, William Miller of Loehampton, New York, by an earnest and consistent study of the prophecies, was led to the conclusion that the gospel dispensation was near its close. He placed the termination which he thought would occur at the end of the prophetic periods about the year 1843. This date was afterward extended to the autumn of 1844. See diagram and argument under Daniel chapter 9 verses 24 to 27. We call his investigations a consistent study of the prophecies, because he adopted that rule of interpretation which will be found lying at the base of every religious reformation and of every advance movement in prophetic knowledge, namely to take all the language of the Scriptures just as we would that of any other book to be literal, unless the context or the laws of language require it to be understood figuratively, and to let Scripture interpret Scripture. True, on a vital point he made a mistake, as will be explained hereafter, but in principle, and in a great number of particulars, he was correct. He was on the right road, and made an immense advance over every theological system of his day. When he began to promulgate his views, they met with general favor, and were followed by great religious awakenings in different parts of the land. Soon a multitude of co-laborers gathered around his standard, among whom may be mentioned such men as F. G. Brown, Charles Fitch, Josiah Litch, J. V. Himes, and others, who were then eminent for piety, and men of influence in the religious world. The period marked by the years 1840 to 1844 was one of intense activity and great progress in this work. A message was proclaimed to the world which bore every characteristic of a fulfillment of the proclamation of Revelation chapter 14, verses 6 and 7. The preaching was emphatically such as might be called the everlasting or age-lasting gospel. It pertained to the close of this age and the incoming of the everlasting age of the King of Righteousness. It was the gospel of the kingdom, which Christ declared should be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations, and then the end should come. Matthew chapter 24, verse 14. The fulfillment of either of these scriptures involves the preaching of the nearness of the end. The gospel could not be preached to all nations as a sign of the end, unless it was understood to be such, and the proximity of the end was at least one of its leading themes. The Advent Herald of December 14, 1850, well expressed the truth on this point in the following language. As an indication of the approach of the end, there was, however, to be seen another angel flying through the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel to preach unto them that dwell on the earth, and to every nation, and kindred, and tongue, and people. Revelation chapter 14, verse 6. The burden of this angel was to be the same gospel which had been before proclaimed, but connected with it was the additional motive of the proximity of the kingdom, saying with a loud voice, "Fear God and give glory to him, for the hour of his judgment is come, and worship him that made heaven and earth and the sea and the fountains of waters." Verse 7. No mere preaching of the gospel, without announcing its proximity, could fulfill this message.